Episode 86, Patrick and Cyprian talk about AI. The team discuss GPT, commercially stable quantum computing, large language models, and the next discoveries and solutions that will shape our future. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Hey, Cyprian, how you doing?
Hey, Patrick, doing very well and looking forward for another great episode of Entangled Things.
Well, we're missing a guest today because it's just you and I, but those are always fun conversations. So let's start off with what we want to talk about today is there seems to be a lot of sentiment, I guess is the right word, negative sentiment about when quantum is going to hit its stride. And I understand it. It's understandable. People have been talking about fusion and other things, but it strikes me as I'm not sure it's the right attitude. What do you think?
Well, on one hand, it's totally understandable, right? Because honestly, the field has been overhyped, right? And every time a field is overhyped, the expectations are just not realistic, right? I've been hearing people talking about having their quantum computers under their desk in a decade, right? And things like that. So it's kind of, from that point of view, it's understandable, right? But from a realistic point of view, honestly, Patrick, I don't think so. If I look at some of the announcements that we talked about in this podcast, yeah, in the last 6 months alone, right, we're pretty much on a spree.
Let's talk. Let's go back to that for a second, because you're spot on. I hear it all the time of, well, you're going to have faster computers. And it's like, okay, but that means you're completely missing the point. Quantum, as you've said many times, is not a replacement for classical computing. Classical computing is going to be around forever. It's not going to go the way of the vacuum tube. It's here. It does things dramatically well. But there's some small spaces of things that it will never be able to do. So Grover's algorithm is endemic of that. Shor's algorithm is endemic of that. And we've seen so many different applications of it being able to do things that, or at least it promising to be able to do things. I should be careful. I don't want to get the hate mail. Because quantum advantage is something that a lot of people are using as the stick to beat quantum with, well, you don't have quantum advantage. You've never shown quantum advantage. And I think we're in a game of semantics there, I think, in a lot of cases. So the first problem is, as you've identified, people don't understand what it's supposed to do in the first place. They think it's supposed to replace the computers under our desks. And you and I have never subscribed to that. I think it's kind of ridiculous to think that's going to happen. But can it solve these big problems that we're not going to solve with silicon? And so that's the open question. And, you know, if you compare it to fusion, fusion's always 10 years away. But if you compare it to AI, which is your sweet spot, your expertise, I remember AI being, oh, that's 10 years away. And then suddenly ChatGPT came and large language models came. And now the future is here. And it really snuck up on a lot of people. Didn't sneak up on you, but it snuck up on a lot of people. So do you think there's a corollary between what's happening with AI and what's going to happen with quantum?
I mean, look, Patrick, I'm a big fan of always looking into history, right? Whether that's recent history or it's ancient Roman, Greek history, right? Doesn't matter. History teaches us always a lot. And if you look at computer science in general, right, there was never a linear type of evolution in any particular field of computer science, right? Yeah. It was always like either kind of going sideways or even decreasing, and then all of the sudden there's a big breakthrough and you're getting to the next level. Right?
Cars were around for a long time before Henry Ford automated the creation so that we could get them so fast. So you're right. There's always this one unexpected bump.
I love that you bring up that, because a lot of people do not remember or do not know these. Some of the very first generations of cars were actually electric ones.
Yeah, that's true.
That is right? True. Yeah. It took more than 100 years to kind of get to the actual like boom of electric cars, right? That's a great example. Oh. But
I have a great idea. Maybe we should use horses.
Right?
It seems to so, go around.
Exactly. So, but yes, with AI, it was really like, and it's even more interesting than that because it was only GPT-3 that actually triggered like the whole revolution. Because we did have GPT-1, we did have GPT-2, right? They were just not at the tipping point, right? They right. were great technologies, but they were just not like, you know, wowing everyone. Yeah. It took GPT-3 and more specifically 3.5, right, to get that hype like to the masses. And there's no reason to believe quantum will evolve in a different way.
Okay, so you mentioned GPT 1, 2, and 3, and most people didn't pay attention to 1 and 2, but I'm sure you did. Weren't there a lot of other things floating around at the same time that could have been interesting, could have been the tipping point? I think we're in that stage now with quantum, because every time we have a guest, a lot of times they're bringing up stuff I've never heard of. I didn't know, you know, until we talked to Qera, I didn't know they were using laser tweezers to move elements around in order to make qubits. It seems like every, you know, few months there's another modality or pitch on a modality that I never even thought of. And it's quite possible we're just, once we get the right modality, I mean, I think Microsoft might be the dark horse here. If they can get their Majorana fermions to work, I believe that's, at least that the science seems to say, that's going to be scalable right from the get-go without the errors and the noise problems, perhaps. Do you think it's going to be something like that that revolutionizes it, or is it just the slow and steady superconductors from IBM and other people?
It's very difficult to say, but again, like to your point, we've had some amazing news, right? And back to the announcement in December, right, from Qera and the Harvard team. Remember what they're doing, and just I'd like to do a very quick recap for our audience because that's amazing, right? Like they use rubidium atoms, right, to build their qubits, right? Those atoms can actually move, and the way they solve the problem of building two qubit gates was by taking two of those atoms, moving them together using lasers, right? Doing the two qubit gate computation, and then moving them back to their places with lasers. What they achieved was they achieved 48 logical qubits, requiring only 280 physical qubits. And this is published in Nature, right? So it's, and at the end of the day, it's Harvard we're talking about, right? So they might be wrong, I don't know, but all indications point to the fact that this result is an absolutely remarkable result.
Right. Right? And it would, if we were talking about this 3 years ago, none of these things that we just discussed were, it was like millions of physical qubits to one logical qubit. In many cases.
Then the other thing that I would like to highlight, it's another announcement that kind of went not necessarily unnoticed, right? But it's also very important. Our good friends from Quantinu, right? They released their racetrack shaped chip called H2, right? Which features 32, notice, fully connected qubits,
yeah,
right? And actually, that particular chip, right, achieved to date what we call, right, the largest GHZ state, Greenberg and Horn-Zeilinger state, which is essentially a simultaneous entanglement of all 32 qubits.
That's amazing.
That's the largest simultaneously entanglement state that has ever been proved. 32 qubits, right? And they are using something that is somewhat similar to Microsoft, right? They're using also topological qubits. So while these are not kind of definitive milestones where we say, yes, we are now in the era of commercial stable quantum computing, these are huge improvements. And then to your point, Patrick, I haven't heard anyone this time refuting Microsoft's claims, right? No. They had an issue in 2018, right? That was a problem, right? But this time with the data that they published, right, I haven't really heard anyone coming kind of heads on and saying, hey, Microsoft, you're wrong.
No.
Which says to me that Microsoft also with their Majorana Zero modes are onto something. And they could really be onto something like big.
So you and I know Microsoft pretty well because we've been developers with Microsoft back in the day. I think that experience was traumatic, and I think it actually will help them do better.
Way better. Agreed.
I think that they're going to do far better because the cautiousness. So like when I think it was the Air Force or one of those customers back in the early 2000s called Microsoft on the carpet about security. They got religion about security, and they've never looked back. That I know, they haven't been. They've also, you know, gotten some strikes against them with security, just like any other trillion-dollar company is going to. What they've also done is they've embraced the fact that security has to be part of their thing. I think that this is having a similar effect on their quantum. They're being very cautious. They're not making claims they can't absolutely back up, and I think that's going to make them better. On, quite frankly.
Yeah, and it also triggered something that I haven't seen yet, honestly, from any other organization, whether it's public or private, working on quantum, which was fully publishing the data. Remember, Microsoft published the full data set, not only the interpretation of it, right, but the actual data set, the raw data that they collected through their experiments. That is a very bold move.
Yeah.
I have to admit. Yeah, yeah. But it was triggered by that painful experience that you're mentioning. So we are seeing progress, and I would even dare to say, Patrick, we see non-trivial progress in the field, right? And then we should also really not forget about the other important player, which kind of goes into a completely different area, PsiQuantum, right, who are building the photonics chips.
Yes.
And what they are really aiming, right, to do is they really aim to build straight from the beginning what they call a mega qubit photonic quantum computer. So they are literally aiming for the million qubits with photonics, right? And they're also doing some significant steps ahead. And then obviously we have all the kind of, I would almost dare to say, regular types of announcements, like new chips from IBM, new chips from IonQ, right, from all the other players out there. So
you mentioned IBM, and they were the first mover in many regards. Most people thought IBM was going to run away with the show. And our first guest, Richard Campbell, good friend of both of ours, I'm actually hoping to go to Dev Intersections, perhaps, in Vegas for a day or two. So I assume you're going to be there on June 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th?
It's May. In May.
Oh, it's May.
It's early May. Yeah.
Actually, so I may make an appearance with you. Maybe we'll record a show.
Would be great.
But the reason I bring up Richard is he asked a question last time I brought the topic up with him in private. And he said what he's wondering is IBM's released all these chips, and he hasn't heard anything on the news about people using them for specific things. And so, you know, it's that kind of, there's little dips, and he's a fan of quantum. He's not a fanboy, I wouldn't say, but I think there's some, you know, people worrying that they've overestimated how soon it could be, but that's the nature of the beast. We don't know it. We're waiting for discoveries. We're waiting for revolutions. And for me as a security guy, I have to err on the side of caution. If Shor's algorithm becomes tenable to run against RSA 2048 in September, I'm already way late in getting ready for it. And so are 99% of my customers. And so here I am ringing the bell and saying, you need to go to post-quantum encryption. and you need to start using the lattice encryption that NIST has approved, and you need to do this well in advance, because the bad guys, if they really want your data, so especially if it's nation states, are going to start gathering that data and storing it, so when September comes, and I'm being facetious here, they can decrypt it. Now, when you have data that has to stay secure for the next 50 years, like missile silo locations and, you know, force capabilities and lithium deposits and things like that, you can't afford to, you know, you can't afford to wait. And so the U.S. government is moving towards that, and we need more of the civilian sector to move that. And there's still not, still a lot of people saying, oh no, you've got 30 years, don't worry about it. You know, yeah, you should do this, but you've got 30 years. And I don't see how they can say that with the surety or with calmness. If that were true, or if that was clear and apparent, which I don't think it is, then I don't think you'd see governments racing to spend the money that's keeping this going. I see a lot of this, the funding for quantum computing, I think, is coming from what its potential is, but also from the fear of, well, we can't let them, you know, insert nation state, get there before us. And so do you think it's more the fear of Shor's algorithm driving the steady state of research, or is it the promise of what it could do with material science, with AI even? I mean, we should talk about that in a minute, but do you think it's more the fear driving it, or the hope driving it right now?
Honestly, I think it's both, right? It all depends on where do you look.
That's right.
If you look at, especially at governments, it's clearly the fear, right?
Right.
Because, well, not the fear,
the concern.
Strategic long-term thinking, right? Yeah. You cannot afford to concede that advantage,
no,
right, to any of your, let's call them competitors.
If it weren't for Shor, I don't know that we'd have this. If it weren't...
You are right. You are absolutely right. Because, you know, it's very easy for someone, especially in government, right, to understand your security is going to be breached, right?
Secrets will be known.
Secrets will be decrypted, right? That's very easy to relate, right? You don't need to understand qubits and entangled states and things like that, right? It's easy. So it's one potential threat or advantage, depending on how you look at it, right? Yeah. It's very easy to understand. And I think that has done a lot for that. Now, if you look into the private sector, I think it's more like the promise of like a lot of business, because if you understand classical computer science, right, you understand that we've hit the limit in many areas, and there's absolutely nothing that we can do with classical computing except small incremental steps forward, right, in order to overcome those problems, especially in areas like material science. But when you think about material science essentially means everything from agriculture to chemistry to space
medicines,
exploration, right, yeah, to healthcare, to you name it. So in that area, I believe is essentially the promise of business, where, again, if you are one of the big players, right, you cannot run the risk of conceding that advantage to some startup that comes mm-hmm. out of nowhere, right, has like a meteoric rise in 10 years and ends up being, I don't know, the new Microsoft, the new Amazon,
Apple,
you know?
It's we've learned in this last round, and since the dot-com boom, it's disrupt or be disrupted. And so you either are going to invent the way that quantum is going to revolutionize insurance, or you're going to watch from the sidelines as some startup does, and you're going to see your lunch get eaten.
And again, to be very like honest and transparent, like, it's not like if you're a classical computing giant, you're going to be kind of wiped out by a big success in quantum, but it's a big chunk of business that you're going to miss.
Yeah.
Right?
It's kind of like AI.
Yeah. And there's going to be a lot of money there. So I think, you know, as I said, depending on where you look, incentives are different, right? But I think these incentives still exist, and they are as important and as significant as ever.
I think that one of the indicators and the canaries in the coal mine is the people who claim to know what they're talking about in quantum, but clearly don't. We don't have that many of them. I've seen a few. I've seen some people on YouTube who've said, you know, this or that, and they've been completely wrong. But it's not as prevalent as we see with like AI, for example. So you and I are both working in AI. You're more of an expert. I'm more of the cyber guy trying to secure it. But I still see a lot of people coming and talking about things that don't make any sense. We're not there yet in quantum. The thing about both of these fields is it's easy to, if you know what's going on, it's easy to see through that, but they might misinform the masses. I think that education is the key as far as people understanding this. And I still see people coming out, some of our guests in recent months, talking about how to educate people into what this is and how it really works. You've talked about what you hinted at just now was kind of like the end of Moore's Law. Moore's Law is, of course, the predictable rise in computing power with classical chips. But we're starting to get to the point where they're so small that quantum effects start to come involved. And I've seen a lot of people trip up and think that that's quantum computing. That if you get to a processor from Intel or AMD where quantum effects are influencing the computing, that's a quantum computer in somewhere. It is not. That's just a point where the chips aren't working the way we want because quantum effects aren't part of the mix, but they're starting to get so small. When that happens, I don't believe that quantum computers are going to fill the gap here by, you know, we'll take over and have these smaller things. But by having quantum computing as advanced as possible when that time comes, we may be able to extend Moore's Law a little longer. We may be able to squeeze a little bit more performance out of classical computers. And so what I'm saying is, I believe that what we're doing in quantum right now will inform classical computing to get to a farther state than it otherwise could.
Agreed. Yes. No. To the specific Moore's Law, right? I think there is a redefinition of that because, like, I think a couple of days ago or 3 days ago, I was watching the announcements from NVIDIA's CEO, right? Moore's Law was essentially always talking about CPU capacity, right?
Yeah.
But what we see now is, interestingly enough, right, that kind of curve is almost like continued by a curve in GPU capabilities that are kind of instrumental for artificial intelligence. And the announcements that NVIDIA made were just like breathtaking in terms of the incremental increase in raw power, but also in dedicated hardware power for the specific components of large language models, right? It's we're not talking anymore about generic hardware for AI, right? We're starting to talk about dedicated hardware for specific components like large language models. So coming back to the discussion about Moore's Law, Patrick, I think in classical, Moore's Law is being redefined and reinterpreted. And there is still stuff that we can do, right? But it will not allow us to overcome the known, like, non-polynomial hard problems. So I'm always looking at it like, you know, there's a ceiling there. We know where the ceiling is, right? We're still kind of moving upwards to the ceiling, but we also know, at least based on our current knowledge, that we will not be able to break that ceiling unless we move to a different paradigm.
Right.
Right. So I would say maybe the traditional Moore's Law for CPUs is kind of fading out. We've got new equivalents for GPUs, right, and dedicated hardware. which will still like move us like ahead at breakneck speed, but the floor, the ceiling has unfortunately not moved. You know,
yes,
it's still there and we see it. And unless we change the paradigm, we know we can't break that ceiling. And I think that's what
it's like the speed of light.
That's what fuels, right? The interest and the money, to be honest, in quantum. Are there disappointments? Yes, they are. Is it bumpy?
Yes.
Way more bumpy than anyone could have thought, right? But again, like, and I don't want kind of to move into purely philosophical realms, but this is how I think about it. Maybe it's not going to be quantum, right? But it's something else. But my thinking is the following, right? If we as a species, right, as the human race, are going to survive on the long term, we need something better than classical computing. Because without something better than classical computing, we will not be really able to leave this planet. We will not be able to defend ourselves against the dangers of outer space, right? And I'm not talking here. I'm not talking here about the small green man, right? I'm talking here about the mile-sized asteroid that can come out of nowhere
and the neutrinos that, you know,
and wipe us out, right? And things like that. So if we don't kind of up our game in material science, in climate, in everything, right? It will be difficult for us to survive on the long term. So maybe it will not be quantum that's still out there, but I think quantum has a fighting chance right now to be that big incremental step in our like long term evolution that allows us to, let's say, be better prepared to survive for the long term. Something has to be there because we know for sure that classical is going to bring us like to forward,
yeah,
but to a limit.
Yeah, the way we've settled in, there's nothing new under the sun in classical computing. It's still silicon. It's still the speed of light limitations. There's you know, size per transistors per unit of space limits. You said you didn't want to get philosophical, but I'm going to get a little philosophical in that I have tried to think about. So I think, you know, Richard Feynman, it took Richard Feynman to say, well, maybe we need to use quantum effects for computing. What else is there after that? Is it, I mean, chemical, we are chemistry. Our brains are chemical computers. And that seems to be a future potentiality that we're not ready to even start exploring. But I could see chemical-based computing being superior in speed and processing only because we have the example of our mind. And we don't understand that. We're still a long way away from that. But other than that potentiality of maybe chemical computing being the next frontier long after we're dead, I can't think of any other thing that would take us beyond what we're already doing. Now, that just means maybe it hasn't been invented yet. But I can't imagine anything else. And the thing about quantum is that whole parallelism thing. The fact that you brought up the 32 entangled qubits, and you and I lecture all the time and tell people what makes quantum special. One of the things I tell people that makes quantum special is this parallelism. Because if I have a 32-bit value in classical computing, there's 4 billion potential values to that number. It's probably an integer in whatever language you're programming in. And all the IP addresses in the world can fit into 32 bits. That's what an IP address is, 32 bits. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But if you think about quantum, if I have a 32-qubit entangled state like you described that has already happened, I can take that entire space of every IP address in the world and calculate against every possible value at the same time. And so that parallelism means that instead of having to do my steps 4 billion times for each possible value, like classical computer does, I can do all of it at once. So if it takes me 100 calculations per IP address in classical computing instead of 400 billion calculations, I do 100. And maybe I do it 100 times to take out the weirdness. So now I'm up to 10,000 calculations with a quantum computer over 400 billion with a classical. And it just keeps getting worse for the classical computer as we go higher. And so I want to just always bring it back down to that. That is the promise of quantum computing, is that parallelism, that ability to really drive us beyond the calculator. Remember the Texas Instruments programmable calculators? I wouldn't go back. I wouldn't go back to the abacus. I wouldn't go back. So I think quantum still has that promise, but we sometimes forget about it because we don't see these little incremental. I mean, I'll be excited when they get to 64 entangled qubits. That'll be a big, big breakthrough because that number is fantastically bigger than 4 billion.
Absolutely.
So, and now I'm off my rant. So other than chemical, can you think of any other modality for computing past quantum? I can't think of any other. And I've thought about it a lot.
Well, if you think about it, right, this is like the way I think about the human knowledge, right, is I always think that our knowledge, if you think about the straight line, right, there's an expanding interval, which is human knowledge. And on the left side of that interval, right, is the small world. So we're moving into smaller and smaller and smaller things, understanding matter, quantum, things like that, right? On the right side of that interval, we're moving into bigger and bigger and bigger things, right? We're seeing farther and farther away in the universe. We're understanding more and more and more, right? Between these two things is what I call human knowledge, right? And this is an interval that is expanding, right? Mm-hmm. So the two limits today of that interval are really quantum, right? And the kind of farthest look into the universe, right? Whatever could be used for computation as the next thing has to be outside these boundaries. Because inside these boundaries, we know, right, that there's nothing that can help us. So whether that will be a new theory that will help us understand how does entanglement work and will kind of open like a whole new thing, or it's going to be some kind of futuristic way of calculation using, I don't know, galaxies and stuff like that, right? It's going to be outside that.
Quarks. Whatever quarks are made of. So in the smaller, or maybe we learn how to calculate with energy. Maybe energy
has
some
facility
we don't
know
about. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I can't imagine what it will be. My mind is biased and limited to live inside this interval that I mentioned, right?
We could write some good sci-fi.
And we really need those, you know, one in a billion brilliant minds that can see outside of the interval. Like, think of Einstein, right? And Feynman and so forth. So I don't know what it will be. I know where it will be. It's not inside, right? It's going to be outside. Having said that, moving back into, let's say, reality or groundedness, as we call it in AI, right? I think our best chance today, at least based on my current knowledge, is using quantum phenomena. How? That's up for debate, right? It's to be determined. But that seems to be even a lot of time after it was initially proposed, right, in the 60s, it still seems to be our best fighting chance to uncover a completely new paradigm of computing.
Well, so like I could make the analogy based on what you're saying of quantum on silicon, like IBM's approach, as being like the gas powered car. It's simple and easy. We use, you know, fuel, oil for lamps and lighting.
We continuously improve it.
Yeah. And then eventually we come around to the new hotness that was around in the beginning, like electrical vehicles. And maybe there's a new modality. Maybe it's, you know, fermions and topological quantum computing. Maybe it's something we've never imagined. you got me thinking. I'm starting. Maybe we should write some sci-fi with a plasma energy as a computing device. So you know, you watch the. I think I could get behind that. I think we're almost out of time. We're at 35 minutes. Usually this is where we reel our guests in. So we have to reel ourselves in. Any final thoughts on this? This has been a great discussion, I think. I'm confident. I'm very confident that this is going to happen sooner rather than later. And maybe that's because I'm a cautious person and caution says you should, if you want to be cautious, you should expect it sooner rather than later. If you want to not be cautious, then you can expect you have all the time in the world. I think you're cautiously optimistic as well.
Oh, yes, yes. And I think, well, Patrick, look, I think we're in a unique position of having a good enough understanding of what quantum computing is, what can it do, what kind of problems can it solve, right? And that's why we were neither victims of the hype nor victims of the delusion. Right? It's like, yeah. Hey, we're not overexcited, but we're also not underexcited.
Our salary didn't depend on it.
We see exactly for what it is. We understand it for what it really is, and that gives us a unique position of being, and I think you described it very well, being cautiously optimistic. Also, as I said, taking into account, if we only look at the last 6 months, right, PsiQuantum, Microsoft, Quantinuum, Quera, and all the others, right, with some very interesting announcements and breakthroughs, right, we see more and more evidence of, hey, this thing might be actually a thing that would work at scale, would be stable. And just to be very kind of honest and transparent to our listeners, right, there's no evidence yet that this is a thing, right? There's encouraging evidence that we're on the right path. Hmm. So I would definitely agree with what you say, at least in my case, I am cautiously optimistic. And what's maybe more important than that, my, let's say, KPI has not changed in the past 24 months. I keep being cautiously optimistic, which basically tells me that we're moving forward. Yeah. Are we moving at the speed that I would like it to happen?
No.
Well, certainly no, right? It's like, you know, my fingers are itching like, can I play with the real one? Can I play with 5,000 logical stable qubits quantum computer? Yeah, well, it's not happening that fast, but it's advancing.
I'm in a weird state because I really don't want it to hit its stride until we're ready, and we're not ready. I keep telling people about quantum encryption and post-quantum encryption, and I'm starting to get a lot more interest in, you know, people wanting to talk about it and understand it. But I think we still need more time.
And there's one more thing before we wrap up that's also encouraging to me. I see more and more institutions in the education space jumping on the quantum train, meaning you see more and more quantum computing courses. You see master degrees in quantum computing. You see PhDs in quantum computing, right? So things are picking up in the educational space, which is the necessary catalyst for creating that generation that you and I call the quantum-born generation, right? Which is a generation that was never biased, quote-unquote, by classical computing, right? They started their thinking in quantum computing terms, right? So they will most likely be the ones like really pushing forward the field. So that's also a positive sign from my point of view.
Right. Yeah. Very interesting. Always great to talk to you and catch up. Anything else before we close out? I think that's we've covered it pretty well.
Oh yeah, I think this was a very interesting discussion. I really love how every now and then we get the opportunity of taking maybe a step back or two and looking at things the way we did today. So I really, really enjoyed our conversation today.
Feels like the old days when we were sitting at a table at a conference and grabbing some time to talk about this thing nobody was talking about. Well, thanks, Cyprian. Thanks to all our listeners. And we'll see you again next time.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.